Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan and these are the top stories of the day. Here's how the Republican tax plan would personally help Donald Trump, by Nash Jenkins. Back in September, when Republicans introduced the first look at their plan for massive tax reform, President Donald Trump insisted that his supporting it was selfless. "It's not good for me, believe me," he said. But this wasn't exactly true. As Time explained then, and now that the bill has been written, nothing much has changed. The bill, as it currently exists, known as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, overwhelmingly helps wealthy Americans like Trump. It's a big project. The bill drops the number of tax brackets from 7 to 5, reduces taxes for most Americans, slashes the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%, and gradually repeals the estate tax. Many of the specific elements of the original plan that would benefit Trump remain intact. The death of the estate tax, for example. Under current law, if you inherit more than $11 million from a deceased loved one, you might pay up to 40% of it in taxes. Trump's net worth is around $3 billion, according to responsible estimates. Under the estate tax repeal, his children won't have to forfeit any of that inheritance when he dies. The bill also does away with the alternative minimum tax, AMT, a half-century-old measure that prevents wealthier Americans from exploiting too many deductions and loopholes. It requires them to calculate their taxes twice, once with every available tax deduction and once with the largely deduction-free AMT formula, and if the latter amount is higher, they have to pay the difference. No longer. This will certainly benefit Trump. According to a leaked tax return from 2005, the AMT increased the president's tax bill from $5.3 million to $36.5 million. That's $31 million he would have saved without the AMT. Republicans have also proposed dropping taxes for small businesses, including those known as pass-throughs. They've become more popular among the wealthy in recent years as a way of categorizing their income under the lower personal income tax rate rather than the corporate tax rate. House Republicans have also proposed lowering taxes for businesses known as pass-throughs, whereby their income passes through to their owners. That income is then taxed at individual income tax rates, which can be as steep as nearly 40%. The new plan could slash the tax rate for these businesses to 25%. The Trump Organization owns more than 500 pass-through businesses. A cyclist to a terrorist, your fear-mongering has failed, by Belinda Luscombe. Belinda Luscombe is an editor-at-large of Time. Each day that I ride down the Hudson River bike path, which is nearly every day, I marvel that it's there. It's not like most of New York City. No traffic, no subway pole hoggers, no delays, no cursing, no people whose earphones are leaking music. Just wind and water and trees, and in the right season, daffodils. Cyclists can ride down the west side of Manhattan all the way from the northern George Washington Bridge to South Street Seaport. It's usually the best way to commute up or downtown. All types of people use it. There are guys with briefcases in their panniers. There are parents with kids on the front or back, going to school or home from soccer. I've seen David Byrne riding there several times, and I once saw Leonardo DiCaprio. I recall, unlike Byrne, he wore a helmet. Because it's New York City, you often see something weird, a gang of young men in leather vests and scarves around their heads riding the chunky share bicycles of the City Bike program, an older gentleman who rings his bell and says hello to every single person he passes, a woman attempting to ride in the rain while holding an umbrella, a dog in a bike basket with a helmet, scarf, and goggles. But unless you want to gawk at the eccentrics around you, there's no reason to stop. Unlike elsewhere in the metropolis, there's very little to impede your movement. That freedom, I suppose, is what made it so easy for a man to drive his car almost a mile down the bike path, intent on taking the lives of those he encountered before coming to a halt outside Stuyvesant High School, which marks the first set of traffic lights for dozens of blocks. He crashed into a school bus, got out shouting and brandishing what many thought were lethal weapons, and was shot. 8 people died, 5 of whom were tourists from Argentina, a nation that has not had a military presence in the Middle East since 1991. In this light, a bike path may seem like a high-value target for terror, one of the most idyllic and carefree and peaceful parts of the city. But in another way, it makes no sense. It's just us cyclists. It's not even that crowded, especially not at that hour, and we're not going to abandon that bike path. Little more than a decade ago, this particular path was an abandoned industrial port wasteland where you had to watch to not step on needles or broken bottles of Thunderbird, which was oddly convenient since you had to avoid eye contact with the hopped-up junkies and aggressive prostitutes who hung out around there anyway. That was scary. Now it's so safe, people sleep in the adjacent parks overnight. It's going to take more than a disaffected, suggestible guy with a poor understanding of his faith to stop people using it. Cyclists were using that same route the very day after the attack. The path was impeded by barricades and police cars, but my fellow bikers and I just wended our way south as best we could. Down side streets, through traffic. Boring, not scary. I would not call this an act of defiance exactly. I'd call it an act of pragmatism. New York City cyclists are just as aggressive as her drivers and her pedestrians. They're going to use whatever space they're given. The attack probably had less deterrent effect on them using that path, in fact, than a couple of inches of rain or snow. Guys delivering takeout on motorized bikes, fools with battery-operated skateboards, and mammals, M-A-M-I-L-S, which stands for middle-aged men in Lycra, who ride like they're in the Tour de France, pose more of a threat to the average bike path user than another attack. Striking the cycle path was a horrible, evil thing to do. I mourn the dead, the fatherless kids. I feel for the horror of 5 families in Argentina who lost loved ones in such a random and violent way. But if the desire was to strike enough fear in locals that they would abandon their small everyday pleasures, then it was also a failure. The bike path was open again the following evening and was well populated by cyclists. There may be a chill in the air, but nothing will cool our resolve. No, Antifa protesters aren't planning on toppling the government tomorrow. By Nash Jenkins. By some accounts spreading online, the Civil War begins on Saturday when far-left radicals will gather in America's streets. The only problem? That's simply not true. For weeks, rumors have circulated among conspiratorial conservatives on Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, and some right-wing news sites that the loose coalition of anti-Trump demonstrators known as Antifa are plotting a revolution to begin on November 4th. A website called Silence is Consent, citing quote-unquote sources, reports that Antifa is planning to purge every single Trump voter, Republican, and conservative American in this country, raiding houses, seizing weapons, and causing absolute chaos. To be blunt, that's not true. At all. Many doomsday conspiracies have some kernel of truth. There really was a Y2K bug in computer systems 18 years ago, though it failed to bring down the global tech infrastructure as predicted. But this one is pretty far afield from its origins. There will indeed be anti-Trump rallies in 20 cities around the U.S. on Saturday, from Atlanta to Honolulu, organized by a left-wing political action group called Refuse Fascism, whose goal is unseating Trump. But its tactics, including but not limited to a passionate speak-out with music and participatory art, are a far cry from violent insurrection. Nor is it likely that the streets will be teeming with angry mobs. Only 990 people have said that they're attending the demonstration in New York, according to the event's Facebook group. It's also worth noting that Antifa, contrary to what many on the right believe, is not a single group. Rather, it's a broad term for a very loose confederation of left-wing activist types, acting both individually and under the aegis of smaller political groups. They're all tenuously strung together by nothing more than an opposition to Trump and a willingness to make it known publicly. That these protests have metastasized in the far-right mind into a literal coup d'etat is a case study in how the internet alchemizes anxiety and immediacy to produce disinformation. Mainstream outlets like Fox News have amplified it, devoting airtime to the impending Antifa apocalypse. President Trump himself has vilified the Antifa protest movement before, referring to bad dudes on the other side after the white nationalist demonstration in Charlottesville, Virginia in August. Snopes, the urban legend fact-checker, has a thorough analysis of how this specific conspiracy germinated. It started with a person named Jordan Peltz, whose social media platforms carry photos and videos of himself dressed in paramilitary uniform. His work, he says, is hashtag fugitive recovery. In a video posted in late August titled Antifa Has to Go, Peltz insinuated that the leftist movement was planning a, quote, civil war in November. In late September, the rumors made it to InfoWars, the online paper of record for far-right conspiracy theorists, which conflated them with the nonviolent protests planned by Refuse Fascism. From there, the prospect of an insurrection on November 4th snowballed, helped in part by wry left-wing commentators having a laugh at undue paranoia. The reality, as is always the case, will likely prove anticlimactic. In an interview with the Washington Post, Andy Z, one of Refuse Fascism's organizers, laughed at the idea of a civil war. The idea, he told the Post, is akin to the massive nonviolent demonstrations in Seoul late last year that led to the impeachment of South Korean President Park Geun-hye. The endgame? Impeachment, the 25th Amendment, they will determine the means and ways when it becomes clear there is a tremendous crisis of confidence, Z told the Post. Paris Hilton is an insanely successful DJ. Here's what happened when we went clubbing with her. By Riza Bruner. Just after dawn on a Monday morning in Ibiza, you will find Paris Hilton decked out in a shiny bathing suit, standing high above thousands of partiers at the mega club Amnesia, spraying giant streams of foam onto the soaked masses below. She's cheerily posing for pictures with fans, hangers-on, and VIPs. She's dancing exuberantly in heels, surrounded by bikini-clad models. As night turns to morning, the bubbly energy that cemented her as a fixture on the party circuit will never falter. As Hilton will be the first to tell you, she's a professional, and this is her business. Inventing getting paid to party. I'm sorry, people want to hate on that? I think it's pretty awesome, Hilton said the day before, sipping rosé and reclining on a shady poolside couch at the Nobu Hotel on the famed Spanish vacation island. She may have risen to fame playing a simpleton on the reality series The Simple Life in 2003, but arriving at the place she is now, creator of a lucrative global business empire and reportedly the highest paid female DJ in the world, has required brains far beyond what that caricature might have suggested she possesses. Now 36, she's the master of an ever-expanding franchise that counts 23 perfumes, 19 product lines, including a new unicorn mist spray, over 45 stores, an upcoming app and VR project, one album and another forthcoming, not to mention her charity work to raise money for underprivileged children. She's gone from heiress to a hotel fortune. Her great-grandfather Conrad Hilton founded Hilton Hotels, to bona fide hotelier. She plans to open her second self-branded hotel site soon, after opening the Paris Beach Club residences in the Philippines in 2013. In fact, she insists, she's barely taken a dollar from her family since flying the coop as a teenager. And then there's the DJ thing. Despite what it might look like to skeptical onlookers, celebrity makes a foray into a glamorous side gig on a whim. Hilton's career as a DJ is a relentless grind. She's on the road 250 days a year, she says, and makes sure her team books her until 4 a.m. whenever they can. As a businesswoman, I want to get the biggest fee possible, so I want to go to the places where they have a budget and it'll be worth my time, she says. That's why she's spending Monday morning at the club for her weekly summer Foam and Diamonds party. Amnesia is a regular gig. She's been a resident summer DJ for 5 years running, putting on an eclectic set for 2 near-dawn hours every Sunday night. This particular gig is something of a homecoming. Amnesia was the first big party Hilton ever checked out on the island after tricking her father Richard into letting her and her sister Nikki jet off to Ibiza as teens. They told him they were headed to Cannes. She met the owner on that first night and says she even knew then that she would one day be behind the booth. When Hilton relocated to Manhattan from California as a teenager, she became one of the world's first modern celebrities known for the simple fact of being famous. She kicked off her career on camera by signing with Trump Model Management, but it was what she did in her off hours that brought her notoriety. It wasn't just a socialite, it was something different, she recalls. I was before my time, I guess. In person, Hilton's voice is low and direct, the girlish baby talk for which she was once known creeping in only sporadically. In her tiaras and hot pink everything, Hilton was a breed apart from more prim and proper socialites. But I didn't really care, she says. I didn't want to be like everyone else. Instead, she paved her own way as a reality TV star, monetizing the public's fascination with her life and pioneering a playbook for future celebrities to mimic. Consider mega model Kendall Jenner, who recently wore a replica of Hilton's iconic bedazzled 21st birthday party dress to celebrate the same occasion. Soon, she became a sought-after party host. Spending time in clubs with the likes of the legendary DJ AM, she developed an interest in the music scene. In 2006, she made her first foray into pop with Stars Are Blind, a bubblegum-inflected track off an eponymous album that charted high on Billboard. Now she's recording her second album, working on what she calls a whole new sound. She promises deep house, techno-pop, and electro-pop, naming Katy Perry, DJ Chucky, Michael Jackson, and Madonna as some of her biggest influences. Hilton's job as a DJ starts when she wakes up, often late in the day after going out to other clubs to support her fellow DJs and friends. Except for Saturdays, when she stays in. She puts together an extensive playlist for the night, with some songs getting a personalized remix or mashup. I've always been a huge tech geek, she says of her approach to editing and playing. Right now, she's using the newest high-end Denon equipment. By 2 a.m., she makes her way to her dressing room. And as she revs up to perform, she's calming her butterflies. I'm a really naturally shy person, so I get nervous in the beginning, she says. With her tonight, as she prepares, are some dancers, her manager, an intern, and her boyfriend, actor Chris Zilka, a stalwart presence who has rarely left her side for over 2 years. Literally, she insists they haven't been apart for more than 3 hours since a fateful first date in Miami. They are effusive about one another. I know he's going to be the perfect man, perfect dad, perfect husband, she gushes. She's the most beautiful girl in the world, inside and out, and I feel so lucky she's mine, he gushes right back. Despite her nerves, in the midst of the backstage buzz, she offers to fix my makeup, giving me an expertly applied flick of eyeliner. Then I'm whisked away to her VIP section, a cordoned-off balcony area with booze and dancers. Way below, sparkling in a bedazzled dress, Hilton throws back her long blonde extensions, puts on her headphones, and cues up the tunes. The Princess of Ibiza is ready to party. The partiers below are an eclectic mix, ranging from what appear to be tweens to middle-aged fans. So Hilton goes right for the feel-good favorites, spinning techno remixes of nostalgic classics like Oasis Wonderwall and Michael Jackson PYT. Tonight, clubgoers are also treated to some of her original music, which she performs live while twirling around a pole. The set ends well past 5 a.m. when she hurries up to the VIP balcony, making a quick change into that shiny bathing suit. Everyone is keyed up, but none more than Hilton. Finally, it's time for the foam, which shoots out into the crowd from industrial cannons at an alarming rate. The club tosses giant inflated pool floaties into the rising sea of bubbles for partiers who want to stay above the scrum. And just as soon as it started, it ends, the crowd dissipating as the bubbles condense into leftover suds. But it's not quite over for Hilton. She's hustled to a windowless dressing room to shower while her entourage smokes cigarettes on beat-up old couches. When she reappears, hair wet, makeup melted away, she's still not ready for sleep. It's not until well past 8 a.m. that the club's attendants kindly but firmly announce that it's time to leave. Hilton emerges into the bright and hot day to retreat to her villa with Zilka, where she'll wind down with some TV, maybe post a few Instagram stories. Eventually, she'll get a few hours of sleep and grab a bite. And then, the club circuit continues, for now. Despite her prominent perch in the world of disco balls and beats, Hilton is already contemplating a future beyond the club. She says she's grown up in the last few years. The baby-voiced character she played in the past has been retired for good. As she pauses to reach for a prosciutto canapé at the Nobu Lounge, a woman interrupts her, flanked by two young children. Immediately, Hilton begins to coo. "I can't wait for the next step in our life, to have beautiful babies," she tells me when they walk away. "Then I feel like my life will be complete, you know what I mean? I may feel like a kid and look like a kid, but I'm not. I would love to just, like, move on, to continue being a businesswoman, but to have a family." Kids are a recurring theme. She hosts weekly kid-friendly DJ parties for local families and mentions a recent visit to an orphanage in India. That's when her eyes well up. "I want to be remembered for so much more," she says. "People are so mean, and they don't know me. I get so misjudged. Just because my last name is Hilton does not mean that I'm some stuck-up brat," she insists, adding that she would even DJ for free. It's the music, the vibe, the scene, the experience of presiding over a party that ultimately brings her pleasure. With that, the Princess of Ibiza heads out into the evening. Tim Cook made $34 million this week thanks to the iPhone X. By Lisa Marie Segarra. Apple CEO Tim Cook saw a substantial increase in his net worth when Apple's stock spiked due to the release of the company's new iPhone. Apple's stock first broke a record when it reached $168.07 Monday before soaring past that thanks to the release of the new iPhone X. The newest iPhone is Apple's most advanced smartphone ever made, released a decade after the original iPhone. Apple's stock ended up hitting an all-time high of $174.10 on Friday before closing at $172.50. Cook's estimated net worth surged to $666,497,782 Friday, meaning he made upwards of $34 million over the week, according to Dan Marsick, director of content at Equilar, which is a data-focused company that reports on CEO compensation. This estimate is based on Cook's shares and options in both Apple and Nike, where he serves on the board of directors. It does not include any property he owns or additional assets that may be in his portfolio, which means Cook's actual net worth is likely much higher. His total net worth is up from $630,225,273, which was his estimated fortune on Friday, October 27, prior to Apple's stock surge when the markets opened Monday.
President Trump's Twitter suspension wasn't funny. It was scary. By Ryan Teague Beckwith. A rogue customer service representative shut down President Trump's Twitter account on their last day of work. An 11-minute outage that prompted the president's critics to celebrate online. But while it was mostly harmless, the brief suspension of the most followed world leader on Twitter raises serious questions. In fact, Trump's critics should be the most concerned about how it happened, since they're more likely to be worried about Russian attempts to meddle in U.S. politics. Donald J. Trump at Real Donald Trump tweeted, "My Twitter account was taken down for 11 minutes by a rogue employee. I guess the word must finally be getting out and having an impact. A former senior employee of Twitter told BuzzFeed that a lot of employees can suspend a user's account and that a few hundred can deactivate one using a process that does not require any special engineering skills. It's one click if you have the rights to access the tool, the employee told BuzzFeed. Technically, Trump's Twitter account was deactivated, not suspended or deleted. That might make sense for a staffer whose job is to look for accounts specifically set up to harass other users. In fact, critics have long charged that the social media company doesn't do enough to fight harassment, especially of women and minorities. But for a high-profile political account like President Trump's, a simple move like requiring two employees to sign off before shutting down an account would be a simple engineering fix. The fact that Twitter didn't make that change, in spite of the huge risk to its own image as seen by Friday's news, raises questions about how it's handling other sensitive questions behind the scenes. The same week that Trump's Twitter account was suspended, a Twitter employee told Bloomberg News that the company ignored evidence that Ukrainian and Russian trolls were setting up accounts. The Daily Beast revealed that Trump campaign advisor Michael Flynn, who later served as national security advisor, followed and retweeted some of the 2,750 Russian trolls in the days leading up to the election. And Jenna Abrams, a Twitter user whose deliberately provocative conservative opinions were spread all over the internet, was revealed to be a Russian troll. Meantime, Facebook's general counsel admitted to Congress that the company should have caught Russian accounts, which were used to buy ads in an attempt to influence the U.S. election. The company's estimate of how many users saw Russian propaganda was updated to 126 million users. And Congress released images of some of the ads, which were bought, showing how they played up divisions among Americans along lines of race and religion. In 2 days of testimony before Congress this week, representatives of Facebook, Google, and Twitter promised that they would do more to crack down on Russian attempts to meddle in U.S. politics. But Twitter's handling of the President of the United States' own account shows that we have a long way to go to earn back Americans' trust. President Trump keeps calling for investigations into Democrats. Here's why that's unusual. By Tessa Berenson. When Donald Trump was a presidential candidate, he'd often lead his crowds in chants of "lock her up," arguing that his opponent Hillary Clinton should go to jail. Now that he's president, his continued calls for Clinton and Democratic officials to be investigated take on a new, inappropriate heft. Over the past 24 hours, Trump has said multiple times that the Justice Department should investigate Clinton and the Democratic Party. At some point, the Justice Department and the FBI must do what is right and proper, he tweeted, specifically saying they should look into the deleted emails, Uranium, Podesta, the server. Donald J. Trump at Real Donald Trump tweeted, "People are angry. At some point, the Justice Department and the FBI must do what is right and proper. The American public deserve it." This marks a major breach of protocol for how presidents typically interact with the Justice Department. While nested within the executive branch, the Department of Justice operates with some independence from the White House, so its work isn't swayed by political pressure. The public needs to have confidence that the Department of Justice chooses to investigate and prosecute a particular person not in order to please the president or others in the White House, but rather because the interests of justice are furthered by that use of prosecutorial powers, says Jonathan Buren, a former federal prosecutor. In a January memo, Trump's counsel Don McGahn wrote that the White House should communicate with the Justice Department on matters that do not relate to a particular contemplated or pending investigation or case. This and other rules concerning communication between justice and the White House, McGahn wrote, must be followed in order to ensure that DOJ exercises its investigatory and prosecutorial functions free from the fact or appearance of improper political influence. If a DOJ prosecutor or FBI agent received information warranting an investigation of Clinton or Democratic entities, the prosecutor should move forward with that investigation based on her considered judgment, says Andrew Wright, associate professor at Savannah Law School. That decision should not be made because Donald Trump wants it done or it would make his political life easier. Trump knows this, at least on some level. The saddest thing is, because I am the President of the United States, I'm not supposed to be involved with the Justice Department. I'm not supposed to be involved with the FBI. I'm not supposed to be doing the kinds of things I would love to be doing, and I am very frustrated by it," Trump said in a radio interview Thursday. "It's very discouraging to me. I'll be honest, I'm very unhappy with it, that the Justice Department isn't going. Maybe they are, but you know, as president, and I think you understand this, as a president, you're not supposed to be involved in that process." Now, even if the Justice Department were to determine on its own that it should investigate Clinton or the Democratic National Committee, Trump's comments would make a legitimate investigation harder to carry out. There would be an appearance that you're doing it for political reasons, says Solomon Weisenberg, who was in the Independent Counsel's office for the Whitewater investigation during Bill Clinton's presidency. The Justice Department declined to comment for this piece. It's worth knowing that the FBI did investigate Clinton's use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State, and in the summer of 2016, former FBI Chief James Comey said the agency did not recommend bringing any criminal charges against her. But Trump's treatment of Comey marks the most significant example so far in his presidency of his willingness to smudge the lines traditionally separating the Justice Department, of which the FBI is a part, from the West Wing. In May, Trump fired Comey, ostensibly because of his handling of the email investigation, but in part, critics worried, because of the investigation into Russian influence in Trump's campaign. According to congressional testimony by Comey, the president had told him, "I expect loyalty." The president has the power to fire the head of the FBI, but it had only happened once before in American history. It's unlikely that Trump's tweets will have any undue sway over the Justice Department lawyers. But the behavior is troubling, says Weisenberg, particularly when you have a president like Trump who doesn't understand anything about the norms of these things. Open enrollment for Obamacare has begun. Here's what you need to know, by Elizabeth O'Brien. Open enrollment for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, begins November 1st. Whether you're one of the roughly 10 million Americans already enrolled, or you're thinking about enrolling now for the first time, here are three things you need to know. The sign-up window is 6 weeks shorter this year. The Obamacare open enrollment period for 2018 coverage runs from November 1st through December 15th for the 39 states that use healthcare.gov for individual and family coverage. This is 6 weeks shorter than last year. Don't procrastinate. Healthcare.gov will have to accommodate consumers in a tighter window than last year, and if the website or call center can't handle the last-minute volume, you risk missing the deadline. Some states that are running their own exchanges have set their own deadlines. For example, New York City has retained last year's January 31st deadline. It's important to shop around. The standard advice applies even more this year. For starters, the shorter open enrollment period means that existing Obamacare consumers who take no action during open enrollment will be automatically re-enrolled after open enrollment ends. If you are unhappy with your 2018 coverage details or premium but miss the deadline, you won't get a do-over like you did last year when you were auto-enrolled for January 1st but could switch plans until January 31st. Secondly, a recent move by the Trump administration to discontinue Obamacare cost-sharing payments has changed this year's math. Premiums for silver plans will rise an average of 34% this year, according to consulting firm Avalir. That's bad news if you're among the 15% of customers who make too much to qualify for premium subsidies. But it could be good news if you do qualify, since premium assistance has grown to match the rising benchmark silver price. More consumers than in previous years will find that their subsidy covers the entire cost of a bronze plan, leaving them with $0 in monthly premiums, according to an analysis by the Wall Street Journal. What's more, consumers living in certain places could find a gold plan that costs less in monthly premiums than a silver plan with higher deductibles, according to a New York Times analysis. No health insurance? You can still get penalized. Despite numerous Republican efforts this year to repeal and replace it, the ACA is still the law of the land, and that means you still owe a penalty at tax time if you don't sign up for health coverage, with some exceptions. The Internal Revenue Service explains the different types of exemptions you might qualify for and how to file for one.
There are two Donald Trumps. Which will show up in Asia? By Elizabeth Diaz. On the eve of his inaugural trip to Asia, Donald Trump is a president divided. There's the populist, wild-tweeting Trump, who started his presidency by pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and worrying Pacific allies that Trump's America was going solo to protect her interests. But there is also a far more traditional Trump, whose actual policies have embraced the approach presidents have taken since Nixon visited China to build international structures to benefit the American strategic interest. "We've got two very different efforts underway," says Elizabeth Economy, director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. "Those two visions need to be integrated in order for the region to understand what they can expect from the United States." There's a lot at stake. Trump will visit Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines over the course of 10 days. The trip comes as North Korea continues to test its nuclear capabilities, as China's economic and military might in the region continues to grow, and as nations are developing economic partnerships with or without the U.S. The White House hopes to shore up U.S. alliances and promote a free and open Indo-Pacific region. Much hangs on how Trump reconciles the two competing visions while abroad. "The question is," says former longtime diplomat Daniel Fried, who coordinated U.S. sanctions policy during Obama's second term, "can Trump in Asia find the right balance between pressure on North Korea and indirect pressure on the Chinese without blowing it all up by being so bellicose that he loses the political credibility he needs to carry this out?" Tweets aside, much of Trump's actual policy on North Korea doubles down on traditional U.S. strategy. Trump's response to North Korea's nuclear advances actually look a lot like Obama's economic pressure campaign. In September, Trump signed a sweeping executive order increasing his administration's authority to sanction companies that finance trade with North Korea. "The spectrum of options didn't change when the occupant of the White House changed," says Daniel Russell, Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs during Obama's second term. "The Trump administration has also been pushing other countries to end or shrink their diplomatic ties to North Korea. In late 2016, the UN Security Council unanimously passed a resolution to crack down on North Korea's use of its diplomatic missions to finance its nuclear program. Since Trump took office, more than 20 countries have restricted North Korean diplomatic activities," Susan Thornton testified to the Senate in late September. "To this administration's great credit, I think it has pursued what has appeared to be a very dogged and sequential strategy against North Korea," says Brian O'Toole, a sanctions expert who worked at the U.S. Treasury during both of Obama's terms. Trump continues to prioritize partnerships with U.S. allies in the region. Trump will arrive in China only after first visiting Japan and South Korea, major partners on North Korea. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe may have the strongest relationship with Trump of any foreign leader. He was the first world leader to meet with Trump after he won the election, and they speak regularly. The U.S. has also pushed back against China's island building in the South China Sea. U.S. Pacific Command continues to patrol the South China Sea to signal freedom of navigation in the waters. Weeks before Trump's trip, the U.S. sent a destroyer near the islands, angering Beijing, as it has done in recent months. But this move was far more routine than the administration's statement shortly after inauguration, which prompted questions of possible military escalation and war in the sea. This is part of more complex U.S. strategy to manage China's rise. North Korea and the South China Sea both present real strategic challenges for both the U.S. and China in different ways. Trump needs China to see that a nuclear North Korea is a strategic liability in the region, while managing China's concerns that the U.S. is simply trying to contain it. "The Chinese play is the critical one," says Fried. "China is not the problem. It should be part of the solution." General H.R. McMaster, Trump's national security adviser, told reporters on Thursday that Trump's trip builds on previous accomplishments. At the Association of Southeast Asian Nations 50th birthday party in Manila, the president will discuss how to strengthen partnerships across the Indo-Pacific to further efforts against transnational terrorist organizations, McMaster said. This trip is an opportunity to build momentum toward shared prosperity and security. And yet, Trump continues to interrupt this policy stream with his unpredictable and America First philosophy. The White House announced Trump would end his trip to the Philippines early and only attend opening festivities for the East Asia Summit, an annual gathering of Pacific nations, not the main sessions. Obama was the first U.S. president to attend the summit, and now critics fear the lack of top U.S. engagement in the meeting cedes the power to China. It is regrettable, says Russell. He could talk in one swoop to 17 other leaders. Trump's transactional approach to policy disagreements also can pose limits. Strategic challenges like North Korea, the South China Sea, and free trade economic principles tend to require sustained engagement that reflects a long-term plan. China has its One Belt, One Road initiative, an ambitious $5 trillion project to expand its influence across Asia with infrastructure projects and military access. Trading China's response to North Korea for trade deal provisions, for example, could be problematic. He would give the advantage to the Chinese, who have mapped out a much longer vision for their own role in the region, says Economy. Though Trump has supported South Korea on the nuclear threat to its north, he has also attacked the country on trade. Trump has repeatedly threatened to withdraw from the 5-year-old U.S. trade agreement with South Korea. Trade may be more aimed at his voters at home than at addressing U.S. security interests abroad. There's a lot of anxiety in South Korea about durability of U.S. commitments, Scott Snyder, director of the U.S.-Korea Policy Program at the Council of Foreign Relations, said. That has to be managed. Trump's own personal diplomacy strategy is often a wild card. Will he prioritize strongmen like China's Xi Jinping and the Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte over allies like Abe and South Korea's Moon Jae-in? Will he continue to go after Little Rocket Man, as he calls Kim Jong-un on Twitter? His own Secretary of State's trip to China in late September was immediately undercut when Trump tweeted that his own Rex Tillerson was wasting his time negotiating with Kim. Trump, McMaster says, will continue to go his own way. The president will use whatever language he wants to use, obviously, he told reporters of how Trump will discuss North Korea on the trip. I don't think that the president really modulates his language. Have you noticed him do that? Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.